This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
They're on practically every corner. Some people feel nervous at the gas pump. Others are outraged. Everybody knows prices are going nowhere but up. Did you know a gallon of gas weighs about 6 pounds or 2.7 kilos? Almost all of it, 5 pounds, 2.2 kilos, goes straight into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide out the exhaust pipe. And that substantial weight for every additional gallon or liter we burn remains as CO2 for 100,000 years. Don't believe it? Stay tuned. We'll talk with David Archer, a top climate scientist. He's the author of The Long Thaw. That's what we're living in, my friends, the time all humans will live in for 10 times the length of all our history, 100,000 years. That's in our second half hour. First, I want to know, when does the oil society seize up? What's the price level? What happens to the American way of life if gasoline goes to $7 a gallon? That's what financial expert Jeff Rubin predicts. Think that's tough? What about $20 a gallon? We're going to dive right into an interview. Remember $4 a gallon gas last year? A lot of us pictured SUVs up on blocks in the driveway. Nobody wanted to give half their paycheck to the oil companies. GM and Chrysler went bankrupt in the exodus from gas guzzlers. Our guest today says, you ain't seen nothing yet. The pain at the pump will only get worse. It seems everybody wants more oil, even if the economy here is in the tank. Did you know China sold more cars than the U.S. last year? Right now, somebody in India is trying out their first car, and a farmer in Brazil finally gets his gas water pump. The oil economy is slithering around the world with big implications for our climate and our jobs. Yet world energy experts say we can't get any more production. In fact, some of America's biggest suppliers are facing declines. Mexico, America's number two supplier, is struggling to fill budget gaps as the giant Cantarell oil field runs out. A Houston oil expert says even the Saudis are struggling to keep up. It's called peak oil, and we're there. Gas prices can only go up. Is that a looming disaster or a good thing? Christopher Steiner is senior staff reporter at Forbes magazine. His new book is $20 per gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
Christopher, why did you write this book?
Well, I've always been interested in how people tailor their behavior according to gas prices. And I thought a long time ago, this is going back 7 or 8 years now, when we got to $2 per gallon across most of the country. I was living out west at the time. And I remember thinking that was a really big deal. And nobody else, I mean, people grumbled a little bit, but nobody else really seemed to care that much. People kept on buying SUVs. I mean, the Expedition kept on selling well. People generally didn't change their behavior whatsoever. We got to $3 several years ago, 3-4 years ago, and again, nothing really happened. We got to $4 last year, as you recall, in May, across most of the country, and everything changed. It was, of course, a front-page story everywhere, every single day. In addition to the fact that you couldn't get rid of your SUV for 20 cents on the dollar, and you couldn't find a Prius for anything close to sticker price, Americans drove 100 billion less miles in 2008 than they did in 2007. And we've never had a drop like that before. In fact, Americans usually drive more every year, almost every year going back to like 1981. So clearly $4 was a giant tipping point for Americans. And so I asked myself, well, going forward, past $4, what other tipping points are out there for us? At what point can we expect airlines to go out of business, but then bring in stuff like high-speed trains for much of the nation? You know, what price of gas do things like that become a reality?
How could you research something like that? Did you go to experts at universities, or what did you do?
I went to any experts I could find. And, of course, there's a lot of people with a lot of different opinions on this type of thing, but generally, you needed some sense of imagination to do a book like this. But I also tried to ground it in as much fact and research as I could. So, for instance, when we talked about airlines, I went to a former airline pilot who used to fly for United and now has a consulting business, a booming consulting business, basically advising Wall Street what airlines are doing well and what airlines aren't and where their futures lie. And I talked to him at great length about, what price does the American airlines, not meaning American airlines, but U.S. airlines, at what point does that paradigm change forever? And, you know, if we came up with the price $8 per gallon based on their operating costs and stuff like that. And so I don't spend too much time talking about how I got to that conclusion financially, maybe a page or two, but we talk about what happens when that type of things happen. And, you know, lots of things happen to our lives, and I think that's the interesting part of this equation. I mean, there's been plenty of books on peak oil that talk about why there's going to be peak oil, but not many books that kind of deal with the interim and how our lives change.
I'll bet some people get steamed at you just for talking about $20 a gallon high prices like that. So how do you react to that?
Well, I have to be honest with you. When the book came out only about 5 weeks ago, and I was not prepared for some of the vitriol I've run into over the last month. I guess I was naive, to tell you the truth. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me now, but I remember my first live radio show with callers, and most of the callers pretty much hated me. And I didn't expect that. I don't know why I thought I'd be loved, but, I've jived with it now, and I try to base most of my responses to people in as many facts and figures as I can, because a lot of people just run at you with platitudes that, and sometimes really have no base in reality. So you just try to combat that type of thing with facts, numbers, and things that we know to be true.
Well, you're not advocating this. I mean, the International Energy Agency has predicted that world oil production could decline by as much as 9% per year, which is just a fantastic drop. So it's not just you that's saying this.
No, it's certainly not just me. And, I mean, there's been a lot of noise around peak oil for a long time. There's been a lot of great books written about it. Certainly Matthew Simmons' book is probably, you know, called The Twilight in the Desert, is the authoritative source on, you know, talking about oil wells and where oil isn't going to come from in the future, because where he thinks, he's a guy down in Texas with a oil investment bank, you know, things, conclusions he's come to as to where people are lying about their oil numbers and how much we can expect a decline. So I kind of wanted to take the next step in the conversation is, okay, so we're at peak oil, so what? What happens? And, you know, there's a couple different schools of thought here. One is kind of the James Kunstler long emergency school of thought, where basically we're going to break down into anarchy and you'll be raising goats in your backyard if you're lucky. You know, otherwise you'll, end up a victim in some kind of crazy resource war. But, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I mean, there's still a lot of oil left in the ground. So let's say oil production goes down 15-20% in the next 15-20 years. Well, you know, that still means we're taking out 70 million barrels a day out of the earth. That's still a lot of oil. Certainly, it's not enough oil to live how we do now. Also considering that there's going to be 2 billion extra people on the globe demanding that oil, who live middle-class lives, that don't live middle-class lives now. Right now, there's only a billion of those people. But the point is, we'll adjust. The price will go up, and we'll use less in everything we do. And so the big question is, societally, how does that affect me and you? What does our life look like?
Well, that's one thing I like about your approach. There are a lot of doomsters who figure we're going back to the Dark Ages, and as Kunstler would say, everything made by hand. You admit there's some serious pain coming, but can you tell us more about some of the positive changes we might expect from higher gas prices?
And certainly, yes, I can. And a lot of people would see these as positive. Some people won't. So in my opinion, they're positives. But I think when you talk about just in general, our dependence on foreign oil, well, there's no quicker way to get off it than the price spiraling out of control. But beyond that, there's all sorts of weird little changes that are going to take place in our lives that are for the better. When you talk about America's obesity rate, which has doubled since 1978 to over 30% of American adults, that is roughly correlated with very low prices in oil. And there's a professor at the University of North Carolina, Charles Kodermatsch, who has linked the low price of oil to obesity, and he has done research that says for every dollar increase that we see the price of gas go up, America's obesity rate will go down by 10%. So, I mean, and that's an amazing statistic. So, and just by going for the gas, and also it saves us a ton of money in healthcare. So as the price of gas goes up a dollar, we save $11 billion on healthcare costs that we would have spent on obesity-related diseases. So you can imagine, you know, a price spike to $7 or $8. Now, we want these types of things to come in over time. You know, if we all woke up tomorrow and gas was $9 a gallon, that would be an economic catastrophe. But, you know, over time, if we get there slowly, people will make the adjustments. They'll live denser. They'll walk more. They'll use their bikes. They'll use more mass transportation. And the difference between a guy who walks to the train just half a mile from his house and gets off the train and then walks another half mile to work, you know, we're talking about a five-minute walk. The difference between that guy and a guy who gets out of bed, goes into the garage, gets into his car, drives to work, gets out of his car and sits at his desk, that's huge when you amortize it over the course of, say, 10 years of working. You know, the other guy missed out on burning hundreds of thousands of calories because he was driving his car. And in general, suburbia and sprawl have a lot to do with our obesity rate. Certainly, they're not the only factor. I'm not claiming that. But as we live more densely and depend on the car less, we will be less obese.
Well, just a note for you and for our listeners to back that up, a professor at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Larry Frank, also did a similar study, and he found a direct correlation between suburbia and overweight to obese people. Listeners can hear that in our program titled Building Madness, broadcast on June 6, 2008, free from our program archive. And don't miss our interview on Globesity in the EcoShock program, May 22, 2009. Well, Christopher, North Americans are starting to get that idea of peak oil, but you were brave enough to bring in the problem of climate change as well, and this from a Forbes man, the Capitalist magazine. What can you tell us about that?
Climate change?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's real. And sometimes I don't know if you call it global warming or global weirding or what it is, because certainly I live in Chicago, and I will tell you the last three summers we've had here have been incredibly cool. I mean, and our winters have been very cold, too. It's bizarre. But clearly, when you look at the raw statistics in the Arctic, there is something happening, and it's generally not good, especially when you consider what rising sea levels will do to a lot of the great cities in the world. And so, you know, I think we all know that at some point we have to put a price on carbon, and that, of course, will affect the price of gasoline greatly, as that's pretty much pure carbon. And that gets to the point of a gas tax, I think, a carbon tax. And that, a gas tax, and I'll upset a lot of people when I talk about this, but, I'd say another dollar per gallon of gasoline that was just a pure federal tax, maybe phased in 25 cents at a time over 6 months at a time, I think that would greatly benefit our country. And I'm not the first one to come up with this idea, obviously. I mean, Thomas Friedman does a very good job lobbying for it in his last book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. But he's right. Basically, we're going to pay $6 or $5 per gallon for gas at some point. Do we want to do it now and take our medicine now and keep that money in the country to build out the infrastructure we're going to need to live on less oil? Or do we want to take our medicine later and send that money overseas to places where it never comes back to the United States?
I'm Alex Smith, heading into a new fall season. Michael Jackson, sorry, not here. While the mainstream is filling your head with toxic fluff, we'll get you the latest climate disruption, heat waves, storms, and ways out of this sorry mess we're in. It's Activist Radio breaking out. Please tell your friends about Radio EcoShock and meet us on the web at ecoshock.org. Now back to our interview with Christopher Steiner. Christopher Steiner is the author of the new book, $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gas Will Change Our Lives for the Better, from Grand Central Publishing. It seems you think some history, social history, is reversible. You predicted cities like Detroit and Pittsburgh could be repopulated again. Why would that happen?
Well, basically, it's a lot easier to go reuse a Detroit or a St. Louis or a Cleveland than it is to go build a new one. And certainly in the future, people are going to want denser lives. We've already seen this effect in some other cities. Certainly, Chicago never had the type of blight or fleeing to the suburbs that Detroit or St. Louis saw. But we had a little bit of that. But, you know, over the last 15 years, Chicago's neighborhoods, the density has gone up. I mean, it's been a really amazing effect. There's a lot of people who want that kind of livable, walkable lifestyle. And there's a lot of people all over the country who want that. And I think it's a movement that's already in place. And that's in not in regards to people fleeing the high price of gas. It's just that they realize they're thinking about their carbon footprint. They're thinking about, you know, being more local. In addition to the fact that you have this aging boomer population that has basically finished up with the big house, their kids are out, you know, they want to go back to the cities. So there's already momentum in this direction. In the future, when people are forced out of, you know, these large exurban homes because it's not worth it to drive everybody 7 miles to wherever they're going, be it the store, be it school, be it work, when they want to get into these walkable neighborhoods, the places like Detroit and Pittsburgh are going to be a natural. I mean, those infrastructures exist. They're there. They're already built. All we have to do is fix up the buildings, patch up the roads, and we're ready to go. And I really honestly believe that those places have a very good future as soon as we start seeing higher gas prices.
But some of the suburbs further out called exurbia, whether it's in California or anywhere in the country, could be abandoned.
I think that's definitely possible. You know, certainly they're going to be worth a lot less money. And you've already seen that happen in some places. When you go to, like, the edges of Riverside, California, those places have been hit harder than any when it comes to the housing bust over the last 2 years. And I think that's part of people realizing that these neighborhoods are not going to be where you want to be in the future. And when you talk about these places that are down 50% in value, you know, over the last 3 years, those are the same places that in the future will be worth even less. Now, it's not going to be nice for anybody to lose their home equity, but we've seen this happen before. We saw it happen again in the St. Louis's and the Detroits and the Clevelands of the world 50 years ago. It's happened before. We survived it then. We'll survive it again, except this time it's going to go in the other direction.
But everything we've been buying has been shipped long distance from China. You've talked a little bit about globalization. What happens to the whole Walmart model of our economy?
Well, Walmart's an interesting case. I mean, some very smart people at Walmart who have been able to harness the effect of globalization better than any other company on earth. And so what you have here is this network of 4,000 stores in America with 6,000 global suppliers. 80% of those suppliers are in China. So they bring the stuff over from China and disseminate it with 7,000 semi-trucks. This is a network built purely on cheap oil. Without it, it can't survive in its current form. Will Walmart morph to some kind of 12,000-square-foot store on Main Street rather than a 200,000-square-foot store 5 miles outside town? I don't know, but I would say that's the only chance they have of surviving in a world of higher-priced oil.
And what about our food? I mean, we use fossil fuels for the fertilizers, for the tractors, for the trucking, for the refrigeration, for the long-distance transport. If oil goes way, way up, are we just going to starve, or what happens?
Well, certainly food's going to get more expensive. And as it does, it's going to be up to a lot of the innovators and entrepreneurs in our country and around the world to figure out cheaper ways to make, ship, and get food around. And I think those things will happen. There's people basically waiting with solutions right now that, say, aren't going to come into play until we get the prices of, say, $7 or $8 gasoline. But those solutions do exist. Will we pay more for our food? We will. Will we starve? No. And I also think we're going to see a lot more local food. Like for me, when I live in Chicago, when I walk into a grocery store, I often see apples. I usually see apples from New Zealand and Washington State. I almost never see apples from Southwest Michigan and Southeast Wisconsin, even though those areas are very close to Chicago and they're very intense orchard areas. They're full of apples, but if I want an apple from those spots that are less than 100 miles from our house, I have to drive to the farmer's market or I have to drive up to those orchards and pay the farmer and pick the apples myself. And who has time to do that? It's very hard to eat local right now, as I think a lot of people know, because a lot of people want to do it. In the future, it's going to be easier. When you walk into a local store, you're going to see local produce more so than, say, now where I see most of my produce comes from foreign countries, Mexico, Chile, and places like Washington State and New Zealand.
So, Chris, let's get crazy now. Gas goes to $16 or $20 a gallon, say 10 or 15 years from now. What would North America's economy and society look like? Can you give us some pictures of that?
Well, I think what we have to hope for is that we get a very smooth, slow climb to those types of prices. And you know, again, if we woke up tomorrow and gas were $15 a gallon, it would be economically ruinous. If we get there over the course of 2.5 decades, you know, I think we will make adjustments. And I think the economy will, the airline industry will basically be gone. Certainly it'll still exist in some extent because there will always be people who will pay to get somewhere quickly. So the airlines, one or two of them will still be around, but most of them will be gone. But what we will have sprouting up in most places is high-speed train networks. And I know California has wrestled with this thing for a while. Whether that actually gets done in the next few years, I'm not sure. But what will make sure it gets done is higher gas prices. And just like California will have its own network that will extend up to Portland and Seattle, the Midwest will have its own network that goes from Chicago to St. Louis to Milwaukee to Minneapolis to Cleveland. And, of course, we already have a small network in the Northeast Corridor, and that will extend down to Atlanta. It'll get down to Florida. And then eventually all those networks will connect. So we'll still be able to travel. It'll take a little longer. But, you know, high-speed train travel, if you've done it, you know, is a very enjoyable thing. And I do think there'll be a day in the next several decades where you can get on a train in downtown Chicago at Union Station here, right downtown, and get off in Midtown Manhattan at Penn Station 7 hours later. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, just on a personal note, I like to listen to the world. I'm sort of an audio person, and I feel the soundscape has been taken over by engine noise. Did you find any point in your research when we'll finally get rid of useless technology like leaf blowers and Sea-Doos?
Leaf blowers, I can't really comment on. People are pretty attached to those because you can plug those in, too.
Oh, right.
But, yeah, I think, you know, stuff like snowmobiles and the more frivolous toys that we use in the woods, so to speak, the dirt bikes of the world, the ATVs, I think, you know, that market for the normal person is going to kind of disappear around $8 a gallon, $10 per gallon. I mean, when it costs $150 just to power your toy for an afternoon of fun, I think people are going to find other ways to have fun. They're certainly going to still have fun. And of course, the kayakers, the canoers, and the wind sailors are all going to appreciate the fact that there's fewer jet skis out there. But of course, there's a lot of people who love jet skis. So there's pluses and minuses here.
Well, wrapping up, have we missed something important? Is there a thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
You know, not really. We hit on a lot there. We did a good job. I do think that we could see $6 gas, which I think is going to be a big moment for America just because we've already been to $4. No one's going to be shocked when we get back there. But we could see $6 in the next 4 to 5 years, perhaps even 3 to 4 years. And that all depends on, of course, the world getting out of the economic malaise that it's in right now. But people don't realize how close peak oil really is. We're probably there right now. And as soon as the world economy gets heated up again, if that happens, we're going to see oil prices go up. We're already back close to $80 now. It's been amazing how quickly we've gone from $30 back in January to $80 now. So there's higher prices in the future.
Even if we don't really get going economically, there's somebody in India right now about to buy their first car, and they'll want to use the oil, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Christopher Steiner, a senior staff reporter at Forbes magazine and author of the new book, $20 per Gallon. Well, thank you so much for your time, Christopher.
Thanks, Alex. I had a great time.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. We'll go out the way we came in with Frank Ace and the Gas Pump Blues.
I don't know what I'm going to do, I'll tell you. I'm fed up
too hot.
To my buddy in Oklahoma today, he told me that all the gas pumps are pumping out there. So why am I paying $2.15 a gallon? I'm talking about lowly. I ain't talking about supreme. I'm going to have to call the governor. That's all there is to it. I'm going to call the governor. See what's going on.
The gas is too hot.
Used to be I could go get me two hot dogs. 5 gallons of gas and a drink for $3. I can't even afford to drive out the gas station. Giving me the gas pump blues.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Jeff Rubin is on the speech circuit talking up his new book, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller. Recently, he was the top man for CIBC Investments, a branch of a ginormous Canadian bank. Rubin was one of the few who advised clients of the coming crash in real estate prices in America, timely warning that must have saved his clients billions. Now he's worked through an analysis of oil availability, and Jeff Rubin sees major changes coming to our society. Oil is running out in the major fields. Just look at Cantarell down there in Mexico, for example. And new sources are more and more expensive to develop. That's a symptom of peak oil. And Rubin claims just the shock when oil hit almost $150 barrel about a year ago, well, that was the real root cause of our current depression. Suddenly, the far-flung suburbs and the SUVs were doomed. All the financial towers of wealth built on cheap oil expansion came tumbling down. At the same time, oil-producing nations are using more and more of their own production. Russians and Saudis and Venezuelans, they're installing their own refineries and chemical industries, and they embrace the car culture. They nationalized their oil. They own it. Less is available for export. Some of what's left is in very dangerous places. The answer, according to many powerful American institutions and corporations, including the Pentagon, is more oil from the Canadian tar sands, the ugliest, most polluting source on the earth. We need 4 million barrels a day, they say, where only 1 million barrels is already polluting the atmosphere. It takes 1 barrel of oil equivalent to make 3 barrels of tar sands oil. 1 for 4. 1/4 of the energy is released into the atmosphere as global warming gases. But Jeff Rubin, in 2 speeches that I've heard, didn't mention climate change once. He didn't need to. The high cost of production, whether it's tar sands or oil miles deep under the Gulf, will keep chopping the carbon economy off at the knees. Even a weak recovery could stimulate oil demand all over the world all over again, and get ready for $200 a barrel for oil. Here's a quick clip of Rubin at Speaker's Spotlight on June 24, 2009.
And if you want to look at what North American roadways will look like, when gas costs $7 a gallon or $2.25 a liter up here, then all you have to do is look at Western Europe, because those folk have been paying those prices for the last 10 years, not because of the price of oil, but because of taxes. And if you look at what's happening in Western Europe, you find very different roadways. First of all, very different cars. No SUVs. GM makes the second most popular car sold in Europe. It's called the Opel Astra. But it would never see the light of day over here. It's far too underpowered and small to meet North American tastes. A whole lot of Opel Astras, not a whole lot of SUVs. But more importantly than the type of vehicles that people drive, is the fact that many, many West Europeans don't drive a vehicle at all. And in fact, if we were to use their car ownership rates as a model of what our highways will look like when we're paying $7 a gallon gasoline, then that basically suggests that 1 out of 5 are getting off the road. In other words, in the next 5 years, the next 10 years, some 50 million Americans will be heading for the exit lane. Because the problem for Detroit is, recovery will be very much a double-edged sword. Sure, at some point the economy will recover, and at some point people will have the financial wherewithal to buy cars. But that same recovery that will give people the financial wherewithal to buy cars will soon bring back the $4 pump prices that caused this recession in the first place, and even higher prices not that much down the road. There's 165 billion barrels of oil in the Alberta tar sands. And beyond that, there's oil trapped in shale and all kinds of formations. Expect Fort McMurray and the Alberta oil sands to be the single largest source of new supply between now and 2025. In other words, to produce more new barrels of oil than even Saudi Arabia. And it can. But recognize one thing. the prices that will be needed to lift 4 million barrels out of the ground a day from Fort McMurray are the exact same prices that will take you right off the road. Because if Fort McMurray is going to produce 4 million barrels a day by 2020, that's not a world of $60 to $70 oil prices. The first thing that you heard out of Fort McMurray when oil prices crashed below $100 was some $50 billion of capital spending that was canceled. Because there's a lot easier ways of losing $3 billion than develop an oil sand project when your cost of extraction is double the price of oil. If we're going to see 4 million barrels out of Fort McMurray, that's a world of $200 oil. And a world of $200 oil is a world of $7 a gallon gasoline, or $2.25 a liter gasoline in Canada.
Jeff Rubin, a Canadian, calls out the tar sands as an ecological disaster and a financial wrecking ball. For one thing, as you can tell, he doesn't expect the North American car industry to come back in anything like the same production numbers. The bright side, if you want to see it that way, is that some industry will return to the U.S. and Canada. The coming high cost of oil will collapse globalization. The closed steel mills and machine shops may return to North America as shipping costs go through the roof. In fact, this big banking financial guru has become a voice for relocalization, not as a fad, but as the forced result of declining oil and gas. Everything, especially food, will take the shortest possible route with the lowest energy costs. In a way, the coming high price of oil, painful as it will be, could help right this ship, could help us become productive citizens who know one another in a community. I say, if that prepares us for a low-carbon future, the transition of peak oil could help us just a bit to prevent climate catastrophe as well. The book is Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller by Jeff Rubin. I've contacted the publisher to see if we can get Jeff on Radio EcoShock. He's worth a read and a listen, in my opinion. Meanwhile, let's follow that gallon of gas from the pump into eternity. Dr. David Archer coming right up. One thing about us, humans imagine their legacy. Think of Stonehenge and the pyramids. I assumed our lasting sign would be nuclear waste, but it could be carbon from your last tank of gas. In fact, our guest David Archer explains how humans are changing the next 100,000 years of Earth's climate. Dr. Archer teaches geophysical sciences at the University of Chicago. In addition to respected scientific papers, he has written a climate primer for students, followed by the award-winning book From Here to Eternity, Global Warming and Geologic Time, published in 2008. Like Alan Robach, our guest next week, David Archer is a frequent contributor to the web's top climate science blog at realclimate.org. Archer's new book is more of a warning. Its short title is The Long Thaw. David Archer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Can we dive right in? Will you tell us what the long thaw is?
The long thaw is the result of releasing carbon dioxide to the biosphere, taking it out of the ground and putting it into the fast carbon cycle of the Earth. Will change the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years. So that's the long part.
So are we predicting an ice-free planet, for example?
I guess if we were to combust all of the coal and wait 10,000 years, I wouldn't be surprised if a significant amount of the ice could melt. I don't know. The East Antarctic ice sheet, I generally don't, climate scientists don't think about it that much because it's so stable. So whether, you know, the whole Antarctica could melt ultimately from combusting all the fossil fuel, I don't know. But it's borderline. It's in there. It's in that range.
We have had hothouse conditions before on the Earth where there was no ice at the poles, or let's say in the Arctic, for example.
That's true.
You say that the right conditions for a new ice age are coming up in a few thousand years, and again in another cycle about 50,000 years. we all know that ice sheets a mile thick over your city of Chicago would be a real disaster. Won't humans of the future, just to be the devil's advocate here, won't those humans thank us for preventing another ice age?
Well, the theory that upon which I based the statement that you sort of attribute to me is that the intensity of sunlight in the northern hemisphere summer is what triggers the onset of glaciation, the nucleation of an ice sheet. And looking in the past, there is a critical value of that sunlight intensity at which, if you're in an interglacial time, the ice sheet tends to nucleate. But it's not real. It's not known very, very precisely what that trigger value is. So the minimum in solar intensity that's coming in the next some thousands of years is right in the gray zone of where that trigger could be. So it's kind of, the model isn't really precise enough to say yes or no. It's sort of a close call. But at any rate, in terms of the social implication of this, is what you asked about, all of this is thousands of years into the future, and there'd be no way that we'd be considering putting CO2 into the atmosphere to defend ourselves against this ice sheet if it, you know, we weren't already doing it. That would be kind of a wacky idea.
Well, James Hansen certainly doesn't think that's a good idea. He doesn't want to see an ice-free world. I noticed in your book you predict a period of climate storms, you call them, for a couple of hundred years during the transition, but you don't give many details. What do you mean by climate storms?
Oh, I meant that after CO2 is released to the atmosphere, there's a few centuries when the airborne fraction is fairly high because it takes time to dissolve in the ocean. And so I wanted to convey the idea of a peak of warming that lasts a few centuries and then a long tail that lasts for hundreds of thousands of years. So as a name for this peak, I came up with a climate storm, singular, not climate storms like, you know, some kind of hurricanes or, you know, events or something like that. That's what I was trying to convey.
Well, what might happen during that peak period? I know I'm just asking you to guess at this point, but what would be a reasonable assumption?
Well, it depends entirely on what the peak temperatures get to. The goal of many organizations now is, and governments, is to try to figure out how to limit the warming, the average temperature of the Earth, to less than about 2 degrees centigrade. And if that's, you know, if we manage to do that, that'd be a very, very different story from if it goes sort of uncontrolled to 5 or 7 degrees centigrade or something like that in the coming centuries. So 2 degrees C is warmer than the Earth has been in millions of years, and last time it was that much warmer, the sea level was significantly higher, and, you know, even that is a pretty frightening prospect. But 5 or 6 degrees, you know, you're talking about a different planet.
Well, that leads me to another question in my mind. It might take me a second to express this. It's about whether temperatures can go down if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions a little later in this century. I mean, say carbon dioxide pollution continues to increase for the next 10 years, but we start emissions in 2030, and that's what the governments and the public are assuming that we could do, and the climate would respond with less warming. But February's Academy Journal with the article with Susan Solomon and her team suggests that natural system may continue on with whatever CO2 peak we manage to hit. The later emission cuts may not matter. Is that your understanding as well?
On the one hand, the result of climate models seemed to be that there was a series of papers in Nature just 6 months or so ago on this, that the most important thing that predicts how, you know, what the most severe climate the planet will experience, the thing that best predicts that, if you sort of try tweaking the CO2 emission scenarios, let's try cutting now, let's try cutting later, and all of that, is the total amount of CO2 that ever gets released. So it kind of simplifies things, because if you, you know, don't cut now, you'll have to cut later. It just sort of makes it easier to think about. So in that case, your question of, well, could we sort of continue business as usual 2030 and then start cutting then, you know, could be sort of right. Now, the problem is that in order to keep the total slug of CO2 below some amount that is going to be the danger threshold, if we wait till 2030, we have to cut by, I forget the exact number, but it's sort of 10 or 15% per year, whereas if we were to start cutting now, cuts of 2% a year could wind us up at the same place at the end of the century. And cutting by 2% a year would be a lot cheaper than cutting by 10% a year. By 2040, you basically have to stop cold turkey or you're over the line.
Well, that's a little bit different than what George Monbiot takes out of that study in his article in The Guardian. He's really concerned about a peak that could be reached soon, and then we really can't unwind from that. It just carries on, and I wanted to get your feeling about that.
Well, it is certainly possible that, during the ice ages, the overall climate was paced by the variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And somehow, in a way that we don't understand very well, the carbon cycle amplified that climate forcing from the orbit. So, you know, the orbit would warm things up and melt some ice a little bit, and then the CO2 would go up and make it warm up even more. Today, the carbon cycle is damping out our climate change by absorbing CO2 into the oceans and into forests, but it's entirely reasonable to imagine that on some time scale, the carbon cycle could start adding CO2 and amplifying what we do, which is sort of a tipping point that I think is what you may be sort of referring to. And the fact that we don't understand the past very well means that we have, you know, zero confidence at predicting the future. So I'd say it's an open question whether the carbon cycle could suddenly go bananas and start putting lots of carbon into the atmosphere that we wouldn't be able to then stop. That's possible.
I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience of reading your book. First of all, it's mercifully short. We're all really busy these days, and when somebody hands me a 500-page tome, I can't do it. But I did read your book, and I was thinking of skipping ahead to your main theme past the first few chapters, but I'm glad I didn't, because I had to unlearn some of the previous science and some myths. I was thinking, for example, about the role of sunspots. You know, there's 1,000 YouTube posters and anonymous blog commenters who say very authoritatively that all this warming is caused by sunspots. And even last night's TV news suggested solar flares may have warmed the Pacific to create the El Nino for this year. How do we know the sun is not the main cause of our present climate shift?
Well, because there is satellite measurements of the intensity of the sun going back through the last few decades when the Earth has warmed in a way that is kind of the smoking gun for CO2, for human impact on climate. So there hasn't been a trend in the sun brightness that could explain the warming.
We haven't had sunspots for a little while.
I guess we are in kind of a low. Just this year, we're in a particularly low. I just was reading an email about that today. I don't know much about it, but yes, I guess that's true.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and most climate models and reports stop at the year 2100, but what happens in the longer future once we've altered the atmosphere and the sea? These are questions that are the topic of a new book, The Long Thaw, by scientist David Archer. David, can you explain how just 1 gallon of gas can keep on heating the atmosphere many times over?
Well, once the carbon is released, there is a fraction of it, about a quarter. It depends on how much other carbon is released, because as you release carbon, it acidifies the ocean and changes its chemistry and changes how much CO2 it will take up. But about a quarter of the carbon from that gallon of gas will continue to be in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years until chemical reactions with igneous rocks on land will ultimately carry the carbon back into the Earth in the form of calcium carbonate. So the Earth has this natural stabilizing feedback mechanism in the carbon cycle, but it takes a long time to operate. And, you know, with it we can understand the climate changes in the geologic past, like the ice-free climates you mentioned earlier, and we also can predict what will happen to the fossil fuel CO2. So it may not be the exact same CO2 molecules. CO2 is taken up by plants, and, you know, there's CO2 dissolving in the ocean one place and coming out someplace else. And so if you actually ask how long will a particular carbon dioxide molecule stay in the air, the answer is very different. It's something like 5 years or something like that. But the crucial thing is that the constant, after you put CO2 into the carbon cycle, it's like a rising tide that floats all boats. There's more in the ocean, there's more in the trees, and there's more in the atmosphere, and it has to stay that way until finally this weathering reaction can clean it up on a time scale of 500,000 years or something.
So we can make a really lasting impression every day as we head to the pumps.
Yeah, it's true. The evolution of our understanding of our place in the universe has been kind of discouraging. You know, it's not clear that the planet was created for us, and we're not the center of the universe. We're not even the center of the solar system, but we are players in geologic time.
You know, scientists started studying the global warming problem really in earnest in the early 1990s, in my opinion. But I wonder, why has it taken us so long to realize the urgency of our situation?
Well, you want to see it in the data. You don't. It wouldn't be like humankind to take precautions based on predictions. You sort of want to see, and then we do start to see it now. But in the 1990s, it wasn't so clear that this was happening. But actually, you know, the forecast for global warming goes back much further than that. It was forecast long before it was observed. I will point that out.
Yeah, about 100 years ago at least.
That's true. Cervante Arrhenius in 1896, he used measurements of moonbeams to predict that doubling CO2 in the atmosphere would raise the temperature about 5 degrees C. Now they say 2.5 to 4.5 or something like that.
And I wonder, too, though, whether the sort of combined pressure of the fossil fuel lobby, who make billions, countless billions out of this, and our own, I wouldn't say joy, but real enjoyment of flying across the surface of the earth in cars and using all the wonders of power, all of that kind of dulls the edge of conceiving that we're doing this damage.
Well, it's true that historically fossil fuel consumption has led to prosperity of nations. There's no question about that. But the prediction is that we can wean ourselves from this at a pretty negligible impact to our standard of living. We don't have to go back to living like the Flintstones. We can come up with smarter ways of doing things. Actually, efficiency, for the next couple of decades, there's a lot more room to cut emissions just by making things more efficient, because it's never been a priority before, so there's lots of what they call low-hanging fruit.
And in the end, you conclude our biggest problem isn't with the technology or even finding the money, but with ethics. Sort of, do we, the common oil and coal burners of this century, have the right to dictate the climate for all conceivable generations to come? David, could you talk to us about ethics and whether you think it's possible a basic sense of right and wrong could still prevent this climate problem?
Well, not only is there the unfairness between those of us benefiting now and those paying the price in the distant future, but there's also a division between the benefit accrues to the rich industrial world and the price is paid mostly in sort of the tropical developing world. So I sometimes you hear people trying to analyze the situation by balancing the cost of cutting CO2 emissions against the cost of the climate change, and it sort of sweeps over the whole fairness issue. I think an analogy could be drawn to slavery, which ended not because it was financially agreeable move to make, but because it was simply wrong.
In the event that we don't make that change, do you have any thoughts about humans, how they could prepare for the long thaw? Tough one.
Boy, I imagine when you have famines and mass migrations, I see, failed states and boy, it's not something, you could pack away some canned goods or something, but geez, that sounds scary.
It's not really something you can plan for. It's just something we either survive or we don't, I suppose. So the alternative is perhaps a working agreement in Copenhagen and a lot of personal changes from all of us, and we hope we make it.
Well, it seems to me like social changes sometimes happen kind of abruptly. And if the forecast for the changing climate is correct, the pressure from the natural world will only increase. And so it seems to me it's only a matter of time till we figure out how to do things differently.
We're talking with scientist David Archer, and I just wanted to ask you as we wrap up, what are you working on now and what do you think you'll be working on next?
I'm working on methane hydrates. They are these weird ice compounds that you find in sediments of the ocean, and they're frightening for climate because there's lots of them, so much of this methane that they could really clobber the radiative balance of the atmosphere if they somehow got out all at once. So we're trying to understand better how the methane cycle works in the sediments. I'm also working on a compendium of classic global warming papers, including my favorite, Svante Arrhenius 1896, which will be called the Warming Papers, kind of like the Pentagon Papers, and another book which is about the carbon cycle of the Earth.
That's fantastic. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Professor David Archer from the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate, from Princeton University Press. Its style is clear. The book is small with a really big punch, I thought. I've read it, and I recommend The Long Thaw as one of the top climate books of the year so far. Thank you, Dr. Archer, for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been fun.
During that interview with David Archer, I referred to another newly developing concept coming out of the latest climate science. Dr. Archer correctly says the bottom line is, how much carbon and other greenhouse gases do we put into the atmosphere? But in his Guardian newspaper column in Britain, climate activist George Monbiot raises another issue. Does it matter when that pollution goes up there?
Well, the atmosphere doesn't care. It doesn't brook any excuses. The atmosphere is not concerned because it's incapable of being concerned. All that counts is how much carbon dioxide is produced, not whether or not there's a good reason for producing that carbon dioxide.
The standard government climate plan assumes a bell curve kind of thing. Greenhouse gas emissions, they just keep on rising to a peak where we manage to get them under control somehow, and then they fall off gradually, maybe after 2050. Their model assumes the climate will cool off as we stop emitting. Now we know that isn't the case. As new research shows, climate change will keep on going long after we stop. As George Monbiot writes in his column, August 31, 2009, three papers released earlier this year changed all that. The first one, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in February, set the scene. It showed that the climate change we cause today, quote, is largely irreversible for 1,000 years after emissions stop, end quote. Around 40% of the carbon dioxide produced by humans this century will remain in the atmosphere for at least until the year 3000. Moreover, thanks to the peculiar ways in which the oceans absorb heat from the atmosphere, global average temperatures are likely to, quote, remain approximately constant until the end of the millennium, despite zero further emissions, end quote. And that ends the quote from George Monbiot as well. Find the whole article at monbiot.com, spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T. In fact, as we now know from David Archer, the climate shift we are now creating is likely to last at least 100,000 years until the slow decarbonizing by rocks takes place. But Monbiot adds a new twist. Drawing from new science released by teams headed by Miles Allen and by Malte Meinhausen, we show that we have very little time left to use fossil fuels before we send the climate into unlivable heating, perhaps as much as 6 degrees Celsius warmer. Again, quoting from Monbiot, there are some obvious conclusions from these three papers. The trajectory of cuts is more important than the final destination. An 80% cut by 2050, for example, could produce very different outcomes. If most of the cut were made towards the beginning of the period, the total emissions entering the atmosphere would be much smaller than if most of the cuts were made at the end of the period. the measure that counts, is the peak atmospheric concentration. This must be as low as possible and come as soon as possible, which means making most of the reductions right now, ensuring that we don't exceed the cumulative emissions discussed in the Nature papers, means setting an absolute limit to the amount of fossil fuel we can burn, which, as my rough sums show, is likely to be much smaller than the reserves already identified. It means a global moratorium on prospecting and developing new fields. End quote from George Monbiot. So there's no need to keep prospecting for more oil or coal. We can't burn what we already have. That's a point raised way back in the 1990s by former Greenpeace scientist Jeremy Leggett. Jeremy will be joining us on Radio EcoShock in a couple of weeks. But the real kicker George raises, we need to cut carbon quickly now, not in the politician's slow process where humans finally clean up their act after 2050. We just can't wait. Monbiot endorses the new film, The Age of Stupid, which is launching a 10-10 campaign in Britain. Cut 10% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions in 2010. Make significant cuts in the upcoming year. We all need to do that.
It's like looking through binoculars, observing people on a far-off beach, running around in circles, fixated on the small area of sand under their feet as a tsunami races towards the shore.
101 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the hottest day ever recorded.
The Age of Stupid is narrated by Pete Postlethwaite, speaking from the year 2055, after the catastrophe. It's set to premiere in North America on September 21st and 22nd, originating from a solar-powered tent in New York City to 442 cinemas in North America and more in another 45 other countries. Radiohead will sing live at the opening. Catch this film if you can.
Every scientific report, all stored on banks of servers. The amazing thing is, we had the chance to avert this. I mean, the conditions we are experiencing now were actually caused by our behavior in the period leading up to 2015. In other words, we could have saved ourselves.
One last quote from David Archer's book, The Long Thaw. If we add up the total amount of energy trapped by the CO2 from a gallon of gas over its atmospheric lifetime, we find that our gallon of gasoline ultimately traps 100 billion kilocalories of useless and unwanted greenhouse heat. The bad energy from burning that gallon ultimately outweighs the good energy by a factor of about 40 million. The enormous world-altering potential of that gallon of gasoline has taken the reins of Earth's climate away from its natural stabilizing feedback systems and given them to us. May we use our newfound powers wisely. End quote. And let's face it, now we know, we are choosing a climate for all conceivable generations of humans. Our brand of species has only been around for about the last 140,000 years. Civilization is less than 10,000 years old. Now we're setting up the planet for 100,000 years or more. Will we leave Eden? Or a tough and troubled place where the remnant huddle near the poles to escape the heat left behind by the fossil fools?
When you use a gallon of gasoline, you consume a gallon of gasoline, you add 5 pounds of carbon to the atmosphere. When I ask people this question in an audience, most people think it's just a minute amount, because it's very deceptive that carbon dioxide is an odorless, colorless gas. It's a gas, it floats. It doesn't seem like it has weight or mass, but most of a gallon of gasoline is carbon. It's a complex hydrocarbon. It weighs about 6 pounds. About 5 pounds of that is carbon, and all of that goes into the atmosphere.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Next week, we wrestle with the demons of geoengineering. Oh, ho, ho, no more blue skies for you. After decades of denial, the carbon lobby has a plan. We'll just block out the sun.
People! Take it easy. We're all upset about Mr. Burns' plan to block out our sun.
I'll talk with real climate expert Dr. Alan Robach, plus Diana Bronson. Climate mechanics are ready to use your panic, and you don't need to change a thing. Drive on out to a brand new world. Everything's great with geoengineering. Don't forget our website, ecoshock.org. You can get our podcast, download all our past shows, plus a bunch of other good green radio. There's no ads and no charge. It's ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for joining us this week. Let's keep our cool.